Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here for another week of financial education. What's up, Ryan?
Not much, Tate. Hope you're doing good.
Doing well. Yeah, we are really enjoying the summer, man. Been up in Nevada for the entire month of July. Ooh. Been doing some fun weekend trips, doing some boating in Tahoe. But the weeks have been extremely busy.
And fast. Where'd the summer go? It's gone.
I know. Exactly.
I know, here in the PNW, it feels like January, you know, December, January, February, March, April are like, just take forever. And then the summer gets here and it's over. That's pretty much my life.
You have to soak it in while it's there. It's been absolutely beautiful. The company's growing and we're raising on deals. We're raising on self-storage portfolio together. And that actually brings us to our guest today, who happens to work for Spartan. And again, you know, we want to provide a wide range of topics on this show. We thought, you know, why don't we take the opportunity to talk to somebody who is boots on the ground? This isn't necessarily your shiny, polished salesperson who's trying to sell you some sort of package. This is somebody who is working behind the curtain on a day-to-day basis and has a wealth of knowledge, but doesn't get to share it with an audience like this very often. So Ryan, do you want to talk a little bit about Derek and his background?
I think it's so critical to hear it from somebody who's actually doing it and somebody who's, you know, you can talk to these turnkey rental providers or talk to somebody trying to sell you something, but Derek is the one out there actually making it happen. He's our senior vice president of portfolio management at Spartan, and he oversees nearly 6 million square feet of self-storage across 15 states. And he has a reporting structure of about 65 employees. So he's basically running the property management side of our business and the asset management side, and over making sure all those things like kind of work in tandem. He does all the due diligence. He sits on our investor committee review. If you're like, okay, well, how does this apply to me? I'm just trying to learn how to do real estate deals. Well, if you want to know about out-of-state real estate investing and how that works, if you want to know about property management, what to look for when you're buying a property, you know, some things that would probably turn you away from buying, how to analyze this kind of stuff, we're going to dive into that.
And how to analyze a market before you even start looking at that property, how to look at a market, do your own little feasibility study to make sure that it makes sense to buy in that market, and some of the ways to drive neighborhoods and make sure that you get the right spidey senses. So sorry to cut you off there, but.
No, you nailed it. I think it's like, should you go look at every property that you buy? We're going to answer that question in the show. And I think, you know, sometimes people are listening to this going, do I want to be an active property manager or active owner of real estate where I'm involved, I'm the captain, I'm making the decisions, or do I want to just be purely passive? And I think this episode is going to give you perspective on which one you want to do. You know, we talk a lot about the tax benefits of being an active manager of real estate. We talk about the tax benefits of being passive and maybe some things that you don't get as an active manager, but what are you trading off at the end of the day? And we think that real estate should be some part of your portfolio in your overall investment thesis at some time in your life, you know, maybe not today, but maybe at some point. But I think this gives good perspective on appreciating, if you do go passive, what goes on behind the scenes, or learning about what it takes to be an active manager and owner of real estate. So with that, I'm excited to bring on the man, Derek Harris. Let's get to the show.
Let's do it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Derek, so great to have you on the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Fun to see you.
Good.
Yeah. So Derek, you know, you've got quite the background in self-storage, and I want to get into that. I think what our listeners are really going to be interested in is like how you find and do due diligence on a property. And then also like you're managing properties in 15 states and what that's like and what team goes behind that. And I think that's really interesting to hear it from somebody actually doing it. But before we get into that, Derek, would you just kind of give us a quick tour of your background and how you got into self-storage in the first place?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Ryan. And thank you for having me. I tell you, when I am hiring people out, I always let them know that you never wake up one day and say, all my life, I wanted to be in self-storage. And most of us have fallen into this industry. I come from the hospitality industry. hotel and restaurant management. And I just stumbled across a position in Houston in 1999. They were looking for someone who understood occupancy and rates. And I said, that sounds like hotels. And I went to the interview, and back in those days, you would take the newspaper and look for a position. So I filled out the application and went to the interview, and the rest is history. I fell into storage, and I joined a great company called Shurgard Self Storage in 1999, and I've been in storage for the past 25 years.
Derek, that's such a big deal that you joined Shurgard. They scaled from zero to 650 self-storage facilities nationwide, and you were part of that. And actually, the founder and the owner of Shurgard is a mutual friend of ours. You obviously worked with him for a long time. He built the first self-storage in the state of Washington in 1972. Can you talk about, you know, people getting into property management and people getting into real estate, how important it is to work for somebody who really knows their stuff and has good values? I mean, can you kind of talk about what it was like to work for Chuck at Shurgard early on in your career?
Yeah, that was a great experience. Chuck is my first and most powerful mentor in the industry. And we really talked about really understanding the markets, the sub markets, and understanding how meeting the needs of the customer, of the tenant. And he really emphasized that you want to make sure that customer service is next to none. Make sure that you can serve your customers when they need it. You know, storage is an at-need-based commodity. And so when you need it, you need to be accessible for them to be able to get their unit and put their items in where it's safe and secure. So Chuck took pride in our mission in taking care of our customer, taking care of our team members, and taking care of our investors. He really pushed on those three points. If we take care of those three, then we'll be pretty successful. So it was a great time with Chuck Barbaro and Shurgard Self Storage, and where we grew, as you said, from zero to over 600-700 assets, and even over in Europe as well.
Yeah. I want to take a moment to point out here and really bridge this for anybody that's listening to this. You know, we're going to talk a lot about self-storage day and operations, but what you just said, Derek, is so important. If you're a real estate investor, it doesn't matter what you're investing in. Taking care of your tenants, or if you have an Airbnb, taking care of your guests, really caring goes so far. People forget that when they invest in real estate, they're investing in a business. And you have customers, whether they're self-storage customers, whether they're Airbnb guests, whether they're long-term tenants. You know, we just this morning, you know, we closed on another triplex in Reno recently. And my wife was texting one of the tenants and said, hey, we want to get your windows cleaned. Can we get access to the interior? And she said, oh my God, I've been asking for this for over a year. And the previous owner said, no, yes, please, thank you. And, you know, what do you think that's going to do to our ability to raise rents next year? You know, they're going to be way more inclined to sign a lease at a higher rate because we're taking care of them. We're saying, hey, we care about your experience. So I think it doesn't matter all the way up and down from a $100 million self-storage facility all the way down to, you know, a little duplex. That goes so far. So anyway, back to you.
Yeah, Tay, I, you know, one of the things that when we hire managers to come into the facility, we really coach them and develop them on they're meeting this person at some type of event in their life, whether it's good or bad, that they're in transition, whether it's death, whether it's, you know, having a new baby or purchasing a new home and so many different things that people utilize storage for. We really train our managers to be great listeners, to really be attentive to what their needs are and be cognizant of what they're going through. And so we can meet that need and also be there to help them go through that process. And we don't want storage to be something else that they have to worry about. We want to take the worry out of, you know, renting a unit, make it as easy as possible, accessible as possible, so they can go on to get to do the things that they need to do. So that's one of the things we emphasize to our managers when they're on the ground. We call them boots on the ground, to make sure you listen to the tenant, make sure you meet their needs, make sure that they're taken care of. So that's one less thing that they have to worry about.
Absolutely.
And you have them also get involved in the community. I mean, I've seen your managers, Derek, you know, get out and get on the radio show, or they get involved in the Chamber of Commerce, or they sponsor local sports organizations. Can you kind of talk to community involvement and how important that is too?
Paramount. I believe a lot of companies miss the part about local marketing, getting into the community, being a part of the community, ensuring that people know who we are. One of the most powerful things about storage, Ryan, is that in the community, people will tell people about our service or our self-storage facility, but they won't tell them by name. So like Free Up Self-Storage, go rent at Free Up Self-Storage. They will say, go talk to Derek at Free Up Self-Storage. He will take care of you. That's that connection in the community, understanding the community and understanding the people that you serve. Because when we look at different assets in different states, we look at that community, we look at that market, we look at the submarkets to see how can we best serve this market and what do we need to do to set ourselves up for success. So our managers go out into the communities, they are part of the chamber, they do marketing initiatives at the local schools, they get to know the teachers, the principals, whatever we need to do to be a part of that community, to support that community. So when there is a need, then they think about us. They think about that manager that took time to come out to visit us, to talk to us about what we have to offer. So very important for the managers to get out to the community.
Yeah, I love it. I just don't, you know, that's one thing that Chuck shared with us in our last meeting with him was that, and we asked him, hey, what's changed in the self-storage industry in the last 50 years? And the answer was like, kind of not much. You know, a lot of it's customer care and customer service. And that's any business that you get into. So if you're a pilot out there and you're thinking about buying your own rental property, to Tate's point, or an Airbnb or something like that, you've got to make sure that you're going to pack a punch of customer service. And I think there's a fine line of, you know, you're still running a business. You're still investing millions of dollars into something expecting a return. So you do kind of have to have that razor's edge of, here's a really good product and a really good customer service and my best foot forward in the community, but also you're there to run a business. Talk about that dynamic a little bit, you know, because we are raising customer rents. We are managing property. We are managing millions of dollars of investor capital. Kind of how do you think about the balance between, you know, great customer service, but also being transparent with the customer on rental increases and realistic costs of doing business?
Absolutely. You know, the manager is the captain of the ship at the facility. And we want to ensure that when we lease a unit at our facilities, that their items are safe, secure, dry, well kept, and that they have access to their goods. And so the manager is always communicating to the tenant about our improvements, about our lighting and security features, and creating that value that this is why we charge what we charge for this particular unit. I'm here on site. It's well kept. It's clean. The gates are working. The cameras are working. So we're always pointing out the value in what they get when they lease or rent a unit from us. And so the manager is constantly upgrading, keeping the property clean, walking the property, making sure that things are clean, and everything is secure, making sure that they get the permits that they need for the fire extinguishers, et cetera. So they're always working to make sure that we're representing ourselves and also making sure that the tenant gets what they need. So they strike a balance between that and going out to marketing and getting into the community, coming back to the facility and making sure that it's accessible and clean. And so there are multiplicity of things that the managers do. And that's why we take time to make sure that we have the perfect fit for that manager, for that asset. Because what I say in the industry, I've learned over 25 years, is that different properties have different personalities. Depends on what market they're in. And so we really try to align that particular manager with that asset to be able to serve the community well.
It's not like Netflix where you just say, hey, your rent went up $50 or whatever, you know, $3 a month or whatever it is, $50 a year. Nah. It's just, there's actually communication and improvements in the amenities, kind of to what Tate spoke to. Derek, you manage 78 properties. You don't outsource it to another property management company. Like you're in charge of the whole portfolio here at Spartan in the field and at headquarters level. 6 million square feet. I think there's like 35,000 units or something like that. You know, for a pilot who's thinking about investing out of state, I wanted just to kind of touch on that a little bit. What goes into managing out of state properties? Because you have properties in West Virginia, down to Florida, over to Colorado, all the way out in Washington and Oregon. I mean, they're right. All over, some in your backyard, right? You live in Houston. Yeah. You have properties right up the road. What's it like managing out of state? What does that take?
Yeah. One, it takes a very good team. I have a very good team of managers and district managers and trainers. The infrastructure, it takes a proper infrastructure to manage in 13, 14, 15 different states. And it also takes that in that infrastructure that there is consistency in how we treat the different markets, understanding the markets and what resources we need to put there in those particular assets. So, for instance, we just purchased a couple of properties in Nebraska, and we identified those particular sites as being very good sites and that we could go in and add certain technology to maximize our ability to be accessible to the tenant. We looked at those assets and say, what type of signage, what type of, you know, do we need to repaint? Do we need to add technology? And then we look at those particular markets and manage accordingly. What is the marketing we're going to use to market these particular sites? So a lot of initial feasibility goes into these markets before we actually enter these markets, because we want to make sure that we can manage them effectively. So the economy of scale. So we look at, okay, if we have one site here, can we add two or three? And so we can leverage that labor in those particular markets. So a multiplicity of things that goes into before we actually go into the market. And even to the point where we'll have boots on the ground is what I call them, a team that will go in and look at these markets and kick the tires, per se, drive all the competition and look and see what they offer to see where is their value added to these particular assets if we take those over. So as we manage a multiplicity of states, we have a team that is connected together through technology and through meeting, and all of it is consistent in how we operate as a company. But then on a micro level, we'll tweak things to serve that community. So a lot of moving parts, but a great team to keep things going.
Derek, I want to get into due diligence and some interesting stories. But you said something there, feasibility, and you're talking all about looking at a market before you go and actually look at a property. So can you talk about what is a feasibility study for someone who's not familiar with that term? And how could that maybe apply? Because we hear this all the time. Oh, I want to buy a rental property. Where should I buy it? It's like, well, that's feasibility, right? Looking at different markets, looking where rent-to-value ratios might make sense, where it makes sense for you to potentially buy a property. So you can talk through that feasibility process.
Yeah, I tell you, and that's a great question, because I think that this is where some of the investors or buyers, they kind of miss the mark. They go out and look at a property and, hey, that looks good and we want to buy that property and it's a good price. But when you start peeling back the layers and looking at those particular markets, we're looking at things like population growth. We're looking at traffic count. We're looking at accessibility to these assets. We're looking at the value at what value can we bring to this particular site as far as security features and different things like that. When we go into a market, we want to see how many competitors are around this particular asset from a 3 to 5 or 1 mile to 3 mile to 5 mile radius. What are those competitors offering? What's the particular unit mix at this particular asset versus the competitors? So we're looking at all of these things to get a competitive advantage for this particular asset that we're purchasing. And then we start underwriting this particular asset. Where are the rates? Where can we push the rates? Dollar per square foot for this particular asset. So there are a lot of things initially on that feasibility that goes into reviewing, assessing this market before we even start saying that we're going to bid or we're going to purchase this particular asset. So I would give the advice that I have to anyone that's going to purchase a self-storage facility or a real estate asset. Do your homework first. You don't want any surprises. Look at everything. Open up the hood, check everything out in regards to that particular market, sub-market, and then start making a decision based on your findings.
Right. I mean, we see this all the time where somebody just drives by a property, says, oh, that looks great, and it's a great price. There's so much more that goes into it in terms of looking at competitors. And even if you're talking about residential real estate, how many other rental properties are there in a 3-mile radius, and what are their rates and what's the competition, right? Because it's more than just, you know, oh, that looks like a great property and that could be a cool thing to own. So it's really cool to look at your process under the hood here.
Absolutely. Even when, now that's the initial feasibility study. If those numbers pan out and we say, okay, this looks to be a good asset to acquire, then we have the second phase of what we call due diligence. And this is where we actually get boots on the ground. We actually get individuals who will go and assess that property and actually go onto the property and start checking out the physical part of this particular asset. Doing that DD process, it's about a 700-point checklist. I mean, we look at things, we open up every vacant unit. And we check every vacant unit for its size to make sure that every size is accounted for. We will check those doors for springs and we'll check all the HVAC units. We'll check inspections of the roof. We'll go on top of the roof and check the roof. We'll look at the signage, the lighting, the gate operating system, the software. We pretty much check everything from top to bottom, from front to back. On that asset, is the asphalt, will that need to be blacktop? Are there any potholes in the RV area? The fencing, the security cameras, how old is the gate system? Are we going to have to replace those units in 2 to 3 years? The approach, the curving, the landscaping, the sprinkler system, anything that you can think of. And this particular process will take, you know, 8 to 9 hours, one day, with a team of 2 or 3 people who are constantly just going all over the property, making sure that we check off on every granular point that we need to. And then we bring that finding back to the committee and we talk about our findings and how we're going to address some of those deficiencies. So it's a, you know, we go from feasibility that this may be a good site and say, okay, yeah, this, you know, let's take a look at it a little bit closer. We get boots on the ground. And we start looking at the physical aspect of the property, and then we come back and evaluate and assess to see if this is still a good investment to make.
Derek, I can't hold back my next question. I hear people all the time say, I've bought real estate and I haven't even seen it. What would you say to that person? Sorry.
I would say bad investment. Run.
I've definitely heard. So I will raise my hand and say I have bought real estate sight unseen. I bought a single family home in Cleveland. It was a turnkey rental property. I did make money on it. Mm-hmm. But it was a pain in my rear end. And, you know, even though I had free flights and the ability to go to that market whenever I wanted to, I didn't want to because I didn't really want to waste my time going to it. But how important, I mean, let's boil down the basics of this question. How is important that the owner or someone that is, you know, on the hook for this property get on site and walk a property?
It is extremely important. Matter of fact, I'm part of a group that I get a vote in what assets we're going to purchase and what assets we're not. And I would vote no every time if we're not going to go on site and assess and evaluate the asset. it is extremely important because you never know what you're going to find. And we have a responsibility to our investors to make sure that we've looked at everything. We don't want any major surprises that's going to affect the investment that our investors have made to this particular asset. So it's our responsibility to go in and assess that risk and to be transparent about what our findings are, because it only takes one major incident. We didn't do the inspection on the roof, and now the roof is leaking, and now water is coming between the walls, and we didn't inspect that. And now you have mold and mildew in the walls, and now we're looking at a restoration of $1 to $2 million. And we didn't know that. Now we've signed on the dotted line. So it is very important that we get the people that we need at the asset to evaluate the asset, to see what we're dealing with, and to be able to either address it before we go full through to purchasing this particular asset, or we walk away from it.
Can you talk a little bit, you were talking about physical property due diligence, and I would politely push back and say, well, you can have an inspector go find all that information. Can you talk more about the feeling, right? I know real estate is not emotional, but like the feeling you get, like that you're looking for, right? I mean, you can assess, you can pull a desktop study on demand. You can run your numbers. You can have a property inspector come by. You can look at the good schools rating. You can see all that data, but like, I'm talking about like, you know, pilots get feelings, right? When they, hey, this isn't working out. I don't like the way this is going, go around. Or hey, I just, you know, let's slow down and let's rerun this checklist or whatever it is. Like what type of like spidey sense do you develop around a property? Kind of how do you kind of look about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And because, you know, I've been in the business for 25 years. And I can pretty much drive up to a site and go, I'm not getting my warm and fuzzy about this site.
Yeah.
You know, there are gonna be some challenges, and that's one of the reasons why we like to get on the ground close and intimate to these assets, because I'm not only looking at the physical things we can repair, the gates not working, this or that, but I'm also looking at, is it going to be a challenge to manage this facilities? What's around this facility that's going to be a challenge? How easy is it for individuals to come onto this site and do business with us? What are the surrounding businesses? What's bringing people to this particular area? And what's going on in this area that's going to make it difficult for this manager to lease units or do marketing? Is it safe in this particular community? The site may be perfectly fine, but what about the community? Is it a community that we want to be in? Is it safe? Is it secure? So a lot of different things when I drive up and drive the market and I'm looking at it, does it give me a good feel? Does this fit what we're trying to build here? And can I add value to this site, or has it served this purpose? And that there's nothing else, that this is where this site is going to be financially. So a lot of things, great question, because, you know, you can pull a lot of different reports and you can fix the gate and fix the roof. But at the end of the day, would you take this property where it is in this community? Because I'll tell you this, Ryan, a lot of managers and investors go, okay, if I could have this property, but if I can pluck it in another community. And so when I look at a property, you can't pluck that property out. I look at and say, does this community fit this property? And then so if my spider senses are okay, then I'll go in and start kicking the tires on it. But good question.
And that skill was developed over the last 25 years of looking at a lot of properties and then operating them. I actually kind of joke around. We have a team at Spartan that all they do is go and look for properties, right, to buy. And, you know, they might find something that then Derek gets his eyes on and goes, we don't buy that. You know, the numbers make sense. It looks good. We're not buying that. And then we'll walk away from the investment. Right. And that's why Derek is at the table making decisions in our investor committee at Spartan. Right. So that, you know, his 25 years of experience is going to pay off in our, you know, sort of getting that quick feeling on, hey, you know, the numbers all make sense. We got all of our budgets and everything. It looks good on paper, but you know, there's just something about the property that doesn't make sense. And I think, you know, that's something that early on in your real estate career, you get through looking at a lot of property. But more importantly, actually running it. Because you can look at a lot of property and never have any experience, and then you have no idea what it's like. I kind of wish that my acquisitions team were all property managers before they were acquisitions, because, right, you know, they would only buy what would be great to manage, right? And so sometimes those things don't line up. And so I think it's an important conversation. Go ahead, Tate.
So I have two questions here. So the first one is, you know, you're talking about operating these properties. I'd like to know, what was your most challenging property that you've ever operated? You've talked about, you know, getting a bad spidey sense about something. Let's talk about a property that ended up in your lap that you had to manage, and it was the most challenging property you've ever dealt with.
Oh my goodness. So this podcast has to stay PG, so I can't use a couple of them.
we can go R-rated or even triple X if you need to, you know, just for a moment.
Yeah, just for a moment. We did once in my career, probably about 15 years ago, we took over a property in a high crime infested area, where they were just, you know, you have break-ins at the facility, but we would have 10 or 15 break-ins in one night. It was just that particular area that was challenging. And so in an asset like that we took over, we have to look at that and say, okay, is there anything that we can do to make this particular facility safe and secure for our tenants, that they feel comfortable in coming on to the property, even in the evenings, or especially our female tenants. And so that was a challenging asset, because we purchased that asset along with a group of properties, so they wouldn't parcel it out. So we had to take that property, and I assessed that property and assessed the area to see, is there anything that we can do to really make this particular asset a part of our portfolio and something that we would be proud of. And so when you're dealing with challenges like that, you have to look at a multiplicity of things. First of all, there has to be a particular certain manager that you want to hire to be able to handle those challenges in that environment. Two, you have to look at all the security features that's going to make this particular asset safe for our customers, our tenants to come and trust us with their items. Another thing that I think a lot of operators overlook is that connecting and being a part of the community and the police force that's in that particular area, partnering with different businesses to help us really clean up that particular area that we are servicing our community, and then getting out there and being a part of the community. So with that particular asset, we really trued up all of the security issues that we have there. The perimeter fencing, the gate, access at night, the lighting, LED lighting. I mean, Ryan, you're a pilot. You could have landed a 747 on that property. We just lit it up. And we had different technology, FreeUp and Spartan. We believe in technology. And so we added a lot of technology to that site. Motion cameras, and then motion detectors on the perimeter fencing, and just a lot of different things that we created value, and we created, you know, for the customer to be safe and secure. And so we were able to really, you know, turn that property around and build the occupancy, and then also our connection with the community. So individuals in the community starts talking about this site, and that you can put your stuff there and it's safe, and they have all of this security and it's well lit and they have a great manager. So go see this manager. They'll take good care of you. So there are times where you will get a difficult, challenging site in your portfolio. It's not to say that it can't be successful, but it's going to take time to understand the market that you're in, understand the community, make those connections, partner with the local authorities, and really put time and energy into building out that asset to where the community, the customers will be feel safe and secure.
You know, that reminds me, you know, not to recommend anyone buy property, no matter what asset type it is, in a crime ridden or D class area. But reminds me of a story. Somebody bought a multifamily building and it had some tenants, some less than desirable tenants in it. And they went to the local police station and said, "Hey, we'll give you 50% off your rent if any police officers want to rent in this building." And like three officers took them up on that. And you better bet how fast those those less than desirable tenants were out of there.
That's a nugget. I like it. I think this is so important because like I think we all get the real estate bug and we all want to go buy a rental property and we all do our calculators and our analysis and hear about how great a certain market is. And then we buy the property because it fits our affordability and it hits our return projections without ever going seeing it or walking it. And then we end up with a very disappointing piece of real estate that consumes a lot of our time. And I was just talking to a gentleman about buying a rental property around a military base. He's a new, I think, lieutenant. I'm probably screwing up the rank, but just starting off at a military base, wants to buy a house around a military institution, you know, a military base here in Washington. And he's asking me, you know, this is my budget and this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to have roommates and I'm going to house hack. And it's like, look, I know that's your budget, but looking at the market, you need to be another $75,000 higher than that, or you're going to be in a completely awful area. And you're going to end up with awful real estate. And right. So, you know, it's not that you can't dumpster dive and go find like really good property and turn mm-hmm. it in, but the amount of effort to clean up a dumpster is outsized to just putting some light improvements or holding on to really nice real estate for just a little bit longer. And I think Derek and I are on the same page. You know, we don't like to buy, we like to buy value. I mean, real estate's all about creating value, and you can really right. create value two ways. You can make you can make money when you buy. Like you're getting a discount on the purchase price, or there's some kind of unique positioning or value you can create. And then there's forced appreciation. And so if you buy a really bad piece of real estate, you might be getting a great price and a great discount. It might match your budget, but don't confuse it matching your budget with it being a discount. And don't confuse the returns that you're going to generate with the return on your time and how much time is you're going to extrapolate on that asset just to make that nice, you know, vanity metric of, I made a double digit return on it. Yeah, but I spent 150 hours on that thing every year, you know, versus a single digit return on your time or return on the investment. And you spent 10 hours a year.
Especially for airline pilots who are making hundreds of dollars an hour. So yeah, that's huge, Ryan.
And Derek, you know, Absolutely. He got stuck with that property, right? Like that was part of a portfolio, take it or leave it, you know, had some good assets, some bad assets, you know, whatever, and sort of had to deal with it. But just think of the time that's allocated. And then you could have spent mm-hmm. that time on the better properties and made them that much better right. for a lot less input. So I think too often people just, they try to slam it into their budget and they try mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. get some kind of a crazy return on it. And you're just asking for problems. You know, go, you know, I told the soldier, I said, look, go walk neighborhoods when you get here and go look for places that you would actually want to live. Like you mm-hmm. as a renter, mm-hmm. where would you want to live? Because you're going to be if you're the target avatar for who you want renting your house, then go pick a yeah. neighborhood that you would actually want to live in. And then you'll deal with you when that soldier mm-hmm. comes through, they're going to be your tenant, right? Not like what you can deal with, right? Don't be a hero. Like go live where you want to go live. And that, I think that's the way we look at it. It's like, I think Derek, I mean, it's such a profound thing. It's like, do I want to operationally deal with this self-storage facility that is planted right next to a trailer park with single wides, tilt over shed, gravel drive out, you know, Dukes of Hazzard car sitting in the driveway, right? And the fence is leaning over because people are just going in there and raiding the place, right? Because we bought those. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe that with the average investor in looking at, you know, something to purchase, they miss the nuance of operating that particular asset once you purchase it. Because I would have voted no on that asset because you're not looking at the extra payroll that I need to operate this facility. Since it's a challenging asset, and since we have so many problems, I need two full-time individuals, not one. And so that's going to increase your payroll. Now, since we have some challenges with break-ins, I'm going to have to hire a security company for about 6 months, okay, to get some things cleaned up. So there are so many other things when you look at it, you go, man, I can purchase this thing and make money and raise rents. But you have to put the time and effort and money up front to get it to where you want it to be. And a lot of times we miss that cost. And so that's where boots on the ground and I come in to look at this asset and say, okay, I'm going to need about an extra, you know, $350,000 just to get started. And they're like, I didn't account for that. Well, I need to fix the gate, the perimeter fencing. I need to equip all of these lights with LED. I need, you know, there are so many different things. And then, maybe. We can start. Yeah, maybe.
Right? That's not
we can do this. Exactly. Yeah. It's not a guarantee. So when you go out to look at these assets, don't look at it. And you're right, Ryan. It fits my budget. But you're going at it the wrong way. You're going at it in reverse. I'm going out to look at it and say, do we even want to deal with this? Okay, these challenges of this asset, and in the future, will it yield a return that we want it to yield? And so when you look at those assets and those challenges, then you start to determine, my spider senses go up and go, nah, the time and energy and money we're going to put in this in the front end is not going to yield that return you want on the back end. We're going to continue to have challenges with this asset. And then look, and so then my vote is a no.
Yeah. And I think that's why we did the bus tour of Houston, right? The Houston portfolio a couple of weeks ago. Derek was on our tour, which was really cool. So the investors all had a chance to talk to Derek and kind of see what goes into these operationally. And Tate and I were leading different groups as well.
Yeah.
And I think the investors even got a sense, like when they walked away from that tour, they were like, you know, I hadn't really planned on investing in this opportunity, but I'm definitely investing in it now, because you can see, I mean, Even an investor who doesn't have 25 years of experience like Derek knows that these are good streets and good assets, quality, and they're Class A, really nice properties. You know, sometimes that might not be as obvious when you're looking at a deal, but I always like that B grade property in an A plus market, you know, versus a plus property in a C market, where that you can't control the crime that happens around your properties. You can't control that. And so that's why we look to eject from, you know, sell properties like that.
You want to be the worst house in the best neighborhood. That's what you want to buy, right? And it doesn't matter whether you're buying a $100 million self-storage facility or a little duplex. Like, you want the crappiest house in the nicest neighborhood.
Yeah. And you want your neighbors coming out saying, thank you. Thank you for fixing up my neighborhood by buying that house and painting it and making it look nice. We will make sure your tenants have a great time here, right? That's what you want. That's like investing. But the other thing too is, like, just for investors looking at commercial, like, you can pull the insurance loss runs on a facility. Mm-hmm. So you can see all the insurance claims that operator has had for the last, I don't know, Derek, was it 24, 36 months on a facility? Yes. So you can see, like, if there's a break-in every month, like, you and they're making an insurance claim on it. Now, they got to be making an insurance claim on it, but you can see all that. And what about police report data? We pull crime data around a facility as well, just to kind of get a sense of what's going on. It's really important. Yeah.
The effort that you put in the front end, it will reward you on the back end.
Yeah.
In regards to, you mentioned the ground portfolio that we were able to, in my 25 years, I have never been able to get on a site with investors ahead of us actually purchasing the sites, which was awesome, because the investors are able to go on the site and touch and feel the asset of what they're investing in. And we were able to take them around the sites and point out the different things that we're looking at in a site to be really sound. Now, I've been fortunate, the sites in the ground portfolio, I saw them being built years and years ago, and these are great sites. And you talk about the communities that you want to be in. You know, a lot of these sites that we were looking at, they're in communities where I call old money. It just recycles. It never goes down. It stays the same. It goes up in well-to-do areas where They're constantly putting resources in those communities, and that facility simply serves that community at those high rates. And those are the assets that you're looking at. That you don't want these big highs and big lows. You want to see consistency throughout the years at how that particular asset is performing. So that was an unusual event, which was exciting because we were able to take the investors around and point out different things that we're looking at, point out the access points, point out, if we have climate control units and what temperature do we regulate the climate in those particular climate control units? Why is there a premium on a unit that's closer to the elevator versus way in the back? So we were able to educate a lot of those investors on what we're looking at as operators, what we're looking at as co-investors on these particular assets, and give them a clear understanding of what our vision is to operate these assets and how we're going to do, what technology are we going to put into these particular assets to make sure that we're competitive. And then it gave us an opportunity as we were driving around to look at the competitors and then explain to them what is our competitive advantage. So that was a pretty awesome tour that we were able to take investors around and really just give them an insight on what we do day to day.
Tate, I know you're dying to jump in. What did you want to add to that?
I am. So, and again, that was a due diligence tour, right? That's what we did. We took investors around. We had a 50-passenger bus. If you're listening to this and you were there, thank you. But it was a due diligence tour, right? To get some education, whether you're going to invest in the project or not, to get on site, touch and feel, talk to Derek and Ryan and Andrew about what it is that they're looking at these sites. So I know the due diligence came back super clean because this is just a beautiful Class A institutional quality investment. I mean, you said there's literally nothing to do on the roofs. I mean, it's super, super clean portfolio. I want another story though. I want to hear what are biggest surprises that you've seen in due diligence. In 25 years, you have to have seen some pretty crazy things on due diligence tours.
Yeah. Not particularly surprises. I have expectations of what a due diligence look like with a site that's 5 years old, 10 years old, 15 years old. And we take that into the age of the site. We take that into consideration. So at these particular sites, some of them were built in 2007, et cetera. Just the upkeep of these particular sites were just remarkable. When it comes to the preventive maintenance on the roof, on the HVAC systems, they had inspections. They keep those clean every year. The elevator inspection, everything was just so tight and presentable. The records were flawless. We were able to get through the due diligence, look at all the inspections. This owner really took pride in these assets. He really cared about the condition of the assets. And so when we went through that particular portfolio and it came back very clean, we were very impressed because what that does is that decreases the amount of capital that we have to put up front to get these items repaired.
Right.
So on the other hand, I've run into a particular asset that was built in 2015. Had major roof issues. And so the roof was not installed properly. And so they had leaks in different areas of the asset. And so that was something that we identified during the due diligence when we go on site, when we get on top of the roof and we check things out. We get a roof inspector to come out and check things out. And that was really a surprise of a site that was fairly new, but had a tremendous amount of roof issues. Leakage that leaked into a lot of the tenants' belongings. And that goes back to Ryan's point. You can pull that information and you see all these claims of items being damaged by water. And so we can connect the dots now. So I go back to due diligence and feasibility of how important it is to get on the site. Don't purchase it, you haven't looked at it, and now you have to deal with all of these claims and the roof, et cetera. So
now let's say you get that report back and you have those leaks. How do you deal with that? Because obviously this is, when we're talking about due diligence occurs before you close. This is, you still have an out. It's just like, you know, your home inspection period when you're buying a house, right? And so you find these issues. So what do you do in that point? Do you go back and retrade on price? How do you move forward there? Or do you just bail?
Yeah. And that's where it's important for us to get those who are qualified to really look into the issue to see how extensive the damage is or what needs to take place to really what we call high and dry, keep the property high and dry. What is it going to take to make sure that this property is sealed, that we won't have any repeat issues with this roof? Once we get that amount and that assessment, we have to make a determination whether we want to retrade or whether we just want to walk away. And so it depends on how extensive the problem is. If we want to, and I go back to challenges with managing a facility, are we confident that if we do this, it will protect our tenants' goods? And that's what we're concerned about. I'm not concerned about the building. I'm concerned about the tenants. The people in the community who lease from me, who I'm saying, I'm going to keep your things dry and safe. So we may look at looking at a retrade if we know that we can seal this building up properly. Or we may say, you know what, this is not a good asset for it. We don't want to have to deal with this reoccurring issue in the future. And then we may very well may walk away from it.
Full circle, taking care of your customers.
Yeah, we're gonna renegotiate. So we're going to go back to the seller and say, we're not paying that. This is a bona fide bid for all these things to fix them all and make them all right. And then we'll get a reduction on the price. And you can get that during your due diligence period. You know, I compare it to an analogy of us buying an airplane, right? You buy a Cessna 172, you're going to open up the logbooks of the seller, and you're going to go back through all the maintenance inspections that plane operator had. You know, did they comply with the latest AD or whatever is on the aircraft, you know, back in this certain date. I'll never forget. I actually was faring an airplane when I was super young pilot, didn't know any better. Anything I can do to get hours, you know, hey son, you know, take this plane to such and such an airport. And this American Airlines captain's going to buy it. So I jump in the plane, engine runs rough as hell at the end of the runway. You know, I try to clean out the mags. Didn't do it. I go back to the thing and we're sitting in the thing and the mechanic's out there doing something. And he's like, yeah, your magnetos were like hanging on by like a thread. Right. And I'm like, oh boy. So he buttons them up, works good, drive to the end of the runway, test everything out. It's great. Then I fly over to the, and that guy took one look at that logbook and he was like, thank you so much for coming out. And then I proceeded to fly that airplane back home. And it's like, when you know, you know, like when you get a property and you start peeling back that property inspection and there's this ding, that ding, this ding, the insurance claims are up the wazoo, you know, you're dealing with something that you're going to have to spend a lot of money on. And guess what? It always costs more than you think. It always takes longer than you think. And you're never accounting for the customer disruptions that you're going to have and the revenue you're going to lose while you're going through those disruptions to fix what you're trying to fix. So
absolutely,
you know, it's not, this is going to cost me 100. And so I'm going to ask for 100. I'm going to ask for 150 because I'm going to go through $50,000 of revenue damage while I fix this issue. So it's always so important to get that right.
Absolutely.
You bring up a great point, Ryan, because this is why experience matters, especially in the self-storage industry. We're looking at a site to purchase and we're going to have to put a lot of work into it. One of the things that we're going to have to do is literally change out all of the locking mechanism or the hasp is what we call them on every door because they're rusted out. And so, and then we'll take those off and we'll paint the doors and refresh, et cetera. And you say, okay, we got a cost on the material. We got a cost on the labor and we're good to go. No, you're not. Because what's going to happen, the property is at 90% occupied. We're going to have to disturb all of those tenants. And when you start shaking the apple tree, instead of those tenants just going through the process, we're starting to remind them that they have items in that unit that probably they don't need, that they've been paying for years. we're going to disrupt that operation. So it's more than just the labor and the material. Yeah. Now we're losing occupancy because we're reminding people who were on auto pay that right. I have those items there. I'll just come and just move them out anyway. I don't want to deal with it. So you have to take into consideration all of those things.
It's so true. And let's also talk about, like, there's improvements you can make to the property that will add value. And there's improvements to the property that you can make that will not add value.
Right.
Because the reason why the Houston deal, why it's so important that those roofs are squeaky clean and perfect, yep, is the tenant is not going to pay you if you have a better roof. Absolutely. On the property. They assume that roof is going to be clear, dry, and clean, right? That is not like, oh, well, we're going to pay extra because it's a better roof. No, they don't care that the air conditioning works or doesn't work. They don't care that their door goes up and down and the hasps go back and forth. They expect that. So if mm-hmm. all those things mm-hmm. need to be repaired, you're not adding any value to the property. No one's going to pay you exactly. more. And in commercial real estate, as a buyer, I'm not going to pay you more because you have working hasp on a door or a better roof. I don't care yep. about any of those things. So like yep. you can dump all that money in there and feel good about it, but it's not going to produce you any income. And so that's why that this property inspection stuff is so important. Like in multifamily, if you're doing a multifamily investment, Tate, you know this, you know, absolutely. Doing multifamily deals.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the electrical panel, up putting money into that adds no value, right? Because they expect that when they plug in their phone, it's going to charge and they, right? But adding a washer and dryer.
Yes.
You know?
Because that drives NOI. NOI is correct. What yeah. is the value driver of commercial real estate, right? Net operating income. So does it bring in more income? Now, will a seller feel more confident in their bid if it's got a new roof, an electrical panel? Hey, sure. This property's clean. You're going to have a much easier time selling the property. Sure. So there is some intrinsic, intangible value in the ease of the sale, the eventual sale when the property's clean and well-maintained, just like the Houston property, right? We're feeling very confident in this purchase because it's like, hey, the roof is tight and right. Roofs, I should say, on all seven of these assets.
All seven.
But, you know, you are so spot on because a new refrigerator, that adds value, right? Somebody's willing to pay an extra mm-hmm. $20, $30, $50 a month because the kitchen's nice, whereas a new roof does absolutely nothing to, you can't push rents. You can't go around to all your tenants and say, hey, rent's going up by $100 this year. Why? Because you have a new roof. It's like, what? I don't care. Like, my apartment looks exactly the same. Yeah.
Yeah. You can try.
You can try.
You can try, but they're going to kind of give you the stink eye, I think.
So, exactly.
This is what you're supposed to do, keep my items
yeah.
dry.
Yeah, exactly.
I think in that particular situation, in like self-storage, what you want to do is go back to that, you know, three-legged stool of Chuck Barbo and what he used to say, you know, take care of the tenant, take care of the team member, and take care of the investor. And in that equation, you can't go wrong. You have to strike a balance with that. And me being, you know, fresh into the industry, he was actually the first person that I met in the home office. And it was very interesting. I told Ryan this story. The CEO and the starter of Shurgard Self-Storage is sitting in a conference room that they told me to go to and sit and wait for my onboarding orientation. And I'm speaking with Chuck Barbo and not knowing that he's Chuck Barbo. And he asked me, he said, hey, you know, what are you going to do here? And I'm a district manager and I'm telling him all of what I'm going to do. And he was like, that's interesting. And he's telling me about the industry and about Shurgard and never said who he was. And then he said, well, I guess I better get to work around here. They got me doing something today. And I was like, well, wait a minute, you know, who are you and what do you do here? And he just chuckled. He said, I'm Chuck Barbo.
I'm the CEO.
The guy. I'm like, why didn't you say anything? But that is the type of person that he is. And to work in that organization to where he believed that putting people first, he believed in taking care of the tenant. He believed in making sure that our investors were taken care of was just paramount to the success of the company. And it's the same thing, the same values that we have here at Spartan and Free Up Self-Storage is that we take care of the tenant and we want to take care of our team members which in return takes care of the investor. So there is a balance that we have to strike when we're looking at these assets. And it starts with, you know, assessing these particular assets that we want to purchase and then going through the process. It's a long process, but we owe it to our investors to make sure that we get it right.
Well, Derek, I wanted to thank you for coming on. I know you're a busy guy running a big portfolio. So thank you so much for sharing your 25 years of wisdom in the space. And I hope our listeners got something out of, because this isn't just about self-storage. This is investing in real estate. And absolutely, all the things that you said today apply perfectly almost to everything. Whether you're buying a mobile home park, a single family rental, whatever it might be, all the principles are the same. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing with our listeners on everything.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Ryan, and good to see you, Tate.
Great to see you, Derek. Thank you.